theory. Not to take this web of dualities as a sign we're on the right track would be a bit like believing that God put fossils into the rocks in order to mislead Darwin about the evolution of life. These dualities show that the five superstring theories all describe the same physics, and that they're also physically equivalent to supergravity. One cannot say that superstrings are more fundamental than supergravity, or vice versa. Rather, they are different expressions of the same underlying theory, each useful for calculations in different kinds of situations. Because string theories don't have any infinities, they're good for calculating what happens when a few high-energy particles collide and scatter off each other. However, they are not of much use for describing how the energy of a very large number of particles curves the universe or forms a bound state, like a black hole. For these situations, one needs supergravity, which is basically Einstein's theory of curved spacetime with some extra kinds of matter. It is this picture that I shall mainly use in what follows. To describe how quantum theory shapes time and space, it's helpful to introduce the idea of imaginary time. Imaginary time sounds like something from science fiction, but it's a well-defined mathematical concept. Time measured in what are called imaginary numbers. One can think of ordinary real numbers such as 1, 2, negative 3.5, and so on, as corresponding to positions on a line stretching from left to right. 0 in the middle, positive real numbers on the right, and negative real numbers on the left. Imaginary numbers can then be represented as corresponding to positions on a vertical line. 0 is again in the middle, positive imaginary numbers plotted upward, and negative imaginary numbers plotted downward. Thus, imaginary numbers can be thought of as a new kind of number at right angles to ordinary real numbers. Because they are a mathematical construct, they don't need a physical realization. One can't have an imaginary number of oranges or an imaginary credit card bill. One might think this means that imaginary numbers are just a mathematical game, having nothing to do with the real world. From the viewpoint of positivist philosophy, however, one cannot determine what is real. All one can do is find which mathematical models describe the universe we live in. It turns out that a mathematical model involving imaginary time predicts not only effects we have already observed, but also effects we've not been able to measure, yet nevertheless believe in for other reasons. So, what is real and what is imaginary? Is the distinction just in our minds? Einstein's classical, that is, non-quantum, general theory of relativity combined real time and the three dimensions of space into a four-dimensional space-time. But the real-time direction was distinguished from the three spatial directions. The world line, or history of an observer, always increased in the real-time direction, that is, time always moved from past to future. But it could increase or decrease in any of the three spatial directions. In other words, one could reverse direction in space, but not in time. On the other hand, because imaginary time is at right angles to real time, it behaves like a fourth spatial direction. It can therefore have a much richer range of possibilities than the railroad track of ordinary real time, which can only have a beginning or an end, or go around in circles. It is in this imaginary sense that time has a shape. To see some of the possibilities, consider an imaginary time-space-time that is a sphere, like the surface of the Earth. Suppose that imaginary time was degrees of latitude. Then, the history of the universe in imaginary time would begin at the South Pole. It would make no sense to ask what happened before the beginning. Such times are simply not defined, any more than there are points south of the South Pole. The South Pole is a perfectly regular point of the Earth's surface, and the same laws hold there as at other points. This suggests that the beginning of the universe in imaginary time can be a regular point of space-time, and that the same laws can hold at the beginning as in the rest of the universe. The quantum origin and evolution of the universe will be discussed in the next chapter. Another possible behavior is illustrated by taking imaginary time to be degrees of longitude on the Earth. All the lines of longitude meet at the north and south poles. Thus, time stands still there, in the sense that an increase of imaginary time, or of degrees of longitude, leaves one in the same spot. This is very similar to the way that ordinary time appears to stand still on the horizon of a black hole. We've come to recognize that this standing still of real and imaginary time, either both stand still or neither does, means that the space-time has a temperature, as I discovered for black holes. Not only does a black hole have a temperature, it also behaves as if it has a quantity called entropy. The entropy is a measure of the number of internal states, ways it could be configured on the inside, that the black hole could have without looking any different to an outside observer, who can only observe its mass, rotation, and charge. The black hole entropy is given by a very simple formula I discovered in 1974. It equals the area of the horizon of the black hole. There is one bit of information about the internal state of the black hole for each fundamental unit of area of the horizon. This shows that there is a deep connection between quantum gravity and thermodynamics, the science of heat, which includes the study of entropy. It also suggests that quantum gravity may exhibit what is called holography. Holography is essentially a phenomenon of interference of wave patterns. Holograms are created when the light from a single laser is split into two separate beams. One bounces off the object onto a photosensitized plate. The other passes through a lens and collides with the reflected light of the first beam, creating an interference pattern on the plate. When a laser is shone through the developed plate, a fully three-dimensional image of the original object appears. An observer can move around this holographic image, being able to see all the hidden faces that a normal photo couldn't show. The two-dimensional surface of the plate, unlike a normal photo, has the remarkable property that any tiny fragment of its surface contains all the information needed to reconstruct the whole image. Information about the quantum states in a region of space-time may be somehow coded on the boundary of the region, which has two dimensions less. This is like the way that a hologram carries a three-dimensional image on a two-dimensional surface. If quantum gravity incorporates the holographic principle, it may mean that we can keep track of what is inside black holes. This is essential if we are to be able to predict the radiation that comes out of black holes. If we can't do that, we won't be able to predict the future as fully as we thought. This is discussed in Chapter 4. In Chapter 5, I consider the question of whether the past is fixed or whether it can be changed by someone warping space-time so much that he or she can travel back in time. However, it seems there may be a chronology protection principle that prevents such warping and makes the universe safe for historians. The holographic principle. The realization that the surface area of the horizon surrounding a black hole measures the black hole's entropy has led people to advocate that the maximum entropy of any closed region of space can never exceed a quarter of the area of the circumscribing surface. Since entropy is nothing more than a measure of the total information contained in a system, this suggests that the information associated with all phenomena in the three-dimensional world can be stored on its two-dimensional boundary, like a holographic image. In a certain sense, the world would be two-dimensional. Chapter 3. The Universe in a Nutshell. The universe has multiple histories, each of which is determined by a tiny nut. I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space. Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2. Hamlet may have meant that although we human beings are very limited physically, our minds are free to explore the whole universe and to go boldly where even Star Trek fears to tread, bad dreams permitting. Is the universe actually infinite, or just very large? And is it everlasting, or just long-lived? How could our finite minds comprehend an infinite universe? Isn't it presumptuous of us even to make the attempt? Do we risk the fate of Prometheus, who in classical mythology stole fire from Zeus for human beings to use, and was punished for his temerity by being chained to a rock where an eagle picked at his liver? Despite this cautionary tale, I believe we can and should try to understand the universe. We have already made remarkable progress in understanding the cosmos, particularly in the last few years. We don't yet have a complete picture, but this may not be far off. The most obvious thing about space is that it goes on and on and on. This has been confirmed by modern instruments such as the Hubble telescope, which allows us to probe deep into space. What we see are billions and billions of galaxies of various shapes and sizes. Each galaxy contains uncounted billions of stars, many of which have planets around them. We live on a planet orbiting a star in an outer arm of the spiral Milky Way galaxy. The dust in the spiral arms blocks our view of the universe in the plane of the galaxy, but we have a clear line of sight in cones of directions on each side of the plane, and we can plot the positions of distant galaxies. We find that the galaxies are distributed roughly uniformly throughout space, with some local concentrations and voids. The density of galaxies appears to drop off at very large distances, but that seems to be because they're so far away and faint that we can't make them out. As far as we can tell, the universe goes on in space forever. Although the universe seems to be much the same at each position in space, it is definitely changing in time. And this wasn't realized until the early years of the 20th century. Up to then, it was thought the universe was essentially constant in time. It might have existed for an infinite time, but that seemed to lead to absurd conclusions. If stars had been radiating for an infinite time, they would have heated up the universe to their temperature. Even at night, the whole sky would be as bright as the sun, because every line of sight would end either on a star or on a cloud of dust that had been heated up until it was as hot as the stars. The observation that we have all made, that the sky at night is dark, is very important. It implies that the universe cannot have existed forever in the state we see today. Something must have happened in the past to make the stars light up a finite time ago, which means that the light from very distant stars has not had time to reach us yet. This would explain why the sky at night isn't glowing in every direction. If the stars had just been sitting there forever, why did they suddenly light up a few billion years ago? What was the clock that told them it was time to shine? As we've seen, this puzzled those philosophers, much like Immanuel Kant, who believed that the universe had existed forever. But for most people, it was consistent with the idea that the universe had been created, much as it is now, only a few thousand years ago. However, discrepancies with this idea began to appear with the observations by Vesto Slipher and Edwin Hubble in the second decade of the 20th century. In 1923, Hubble discovered that many faint patches of light, called nebulae, were in fact other galaxies, vast collections of stars like our sun, but at a great distance. In order for them to appear so small and faint, the distances had to be so great that light from them would have taken millions or even billions of years to reach us. This indicated that the beginning of the universe couldn't have been just a few thousand years ago. Chronology of discoveries made by Slipher and Hubble between 1910 and 1930. 1912. Slipher measured light from four nebulae, finding three of them redshifted, but Andromeda blue-shifted. His interpretation was that Andromeda is moving toward us while the other nebulae move away from us. 1912 to 1914, Slipher measured 12 more nebulae. All except one were red-shifted. 1914. Slipher presented his findings to the American Astronomical Society. Hubble heard the presentation. 1918, Hubble began to investigate the nebulae. 1923. Hubble determined that the spiral nebulae, including Andromeda, are other galaxies. 1914 to 1925. Slipher and others kept measuring Doppler shifts. The score in 1925 was 43 red shifts to 2 blue shifts. 1929. Hubble and Milton Humason, after continuing to measure Doppler shifts and finding that on the large scale every galaxy appears to be receding from every other, announced their discovery that the universe is expanding. But the second thing Hubble discovered was even more remarkable. Astronomers had learned that by analyzing the light from other galaxies, it was possible to measure whether they're moving toward us or away from us. To their great surprise, they found that nearly all galaxies are moving away. Moreover, the farther they are from us, the faster they're moving away. It was Hubble who recognized the dramatic implications of this discovery. On the large scale, every galaxy is moving away from every other galaxy. The universe is expanding. Hubble's Law. By analyzing the light from other galaxies, Edwin Hubble discovered in the 1920s that nearly all galaxies are moving away from us at a velocity, v, that is proportional to their distance, r, from the Earth. So, v equals h times r. This important observation, known as Hubble's Law, established that the universe is expanding, with the Hubble constant h setting the rate of expansion. The Doppler effect. The relationship between speed and wavelength, which is called the Doppler effect, is an everyday experience. Listen to a plane that passes overhead. As it approaches, its engine sounds at a higher pitch, and when it passes and disappears, it sounds at a lower pitch. The higher pitch corresponds to sound waves with a shorter wavelength, the distance between one wave crest and the next, and a higher frequency, the number of waves per second. This is because as the plane moves toward you, it will be nearer to you when it emits the next wave crest, lessening the distance between wave crests. Similarly, as the plane moves away, the wavelengths increase and the pitch you perceive is lower. The Doppler effect is also true of light waves. If a galaxy were to remain at a constant distance from Earth, characteristic lines in the spectrum would appear in a normal or standard position. However, if the galaxy is moving away from us, the waves will appear elongated or stretched. And if the galaxy is moving towards us, then the waves will appear to be compressed. The discovery of the expansion of the universe was one of the great intellectual revolutions of the 20th century. It came as a total surprise, and it completely changed the discussion of the origin of the universe. If the galaxies are moving apart, they must have been closer together in the past. From the present rate of expansion, we can estimate that they must have been very close together indeed, 10 to 15 billion years ago. As described in the last chapter, Roger Penrose and I were able to show that Einstein's general theory of relativity implied that the universe and time itself must have had a beginning in a tremendous explosion. Here was the explanation of why the sky at night is dark. No star could have been shining longer than 10 to 15 billion years, the time since the Big Bang. The Hot Big Bang. If general relativity were correct, the universe started with an infinite temperature and density at the Big Bang singularity. As the universe expanded, the temperature of the radiation decreased. At about a hundredth of a second after the Big Bang, the temperature would have been 100 billion degrees, and the universe would have contained mostly photons, electrons, and neutrinos, extremely light particles, and their antiparticles, together with some protons and neutrons. For the next 3 minutes, as the universe cooled to about 1 billion degrees, protons and neutrons would have begun combining to form the nuclei of helium, hydrogen, and other light elements. Hundreds of thousands of years later, when the temperature had dropped to a few thousand degrees, the electrons would have slowed down to the point where the light nuclei could capture them to form atoms. However, the heavier elements of which we are made, such as carbon and oxygen, would not form until billions of years later from the burning of helium in the center of stars. This picture of a dense, hot, early stage of the universe was first put forward by the scientist George Gamow in 1948, in a paper he wrote with Ralph Alther, which made the remarkable prediction that radiation from this very hot early stage should still be around today. Their prediction was confirmed in 1965 when the physicists Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson observed the cosmic microwave background radiation. We're used to the idea that events are caused by earlier events, which in turn are caused by still earlier events. There's a chain of causality stretching back into the past. But suppose this chain has a beginning. Suppose there was a first event. What caused it? This was not a question that many scientists wanted to address. They tried to avoid it, either by claiming, like the Russians, that the universe didn't have a beginning, or by maintaining that the origin of the universe didn't lie within the realm of science, but belonged to metaphysics or religion. In my opinion, this is not a position any true scientist should take. If the laws of science are suspended at the beginning of the universe, might not they fail at other times also? A law is not a law if it only holds sometimes. We must try to understand the beginning of the universe on the basis of science. It may be a task beyond our powers, but we should at least make the attempt. While the theorems that Penrose and I proved showed that the universe must have had a beginning, they didn't give much information about the nature of that beginning. They indicated that the universe began in a Big Bang, a point where the whole universe and everything in it was scrunched up into a single point of infinite density. At this point, Einstein's general theory of relativity would have broken down, so it can't be used to predict in what manner the universe began. One is left with the origin of the universe apparently being beyond the scope of science. This was not a conclusion that scientists should be happy with. As chapters 1 and 2 point out, the reason general relativity broke down near the Big Bang is that it didn't incorporate the uncertainty principle, the random element of quantum theory that Einstein had objected to on the grounds that God does not play dice. However, all the evidence is that God is quite a gambler. One can think of the universe as being like a giant casino, with dice being rolled or wheels being spun on every occasion. You might think that operating a casino is a very chancy business, because you risk losing money each time dice are thrown or the wheel is spun. But over a large number of bets, the gains and losses average out to a result that can be predicted, even though the result of any particular bet cannot be predicted. The casino operators make sure the odds average out in their favor. That's why casino operators are so rich. The only chance you have of winning against them is to stake all your money on a few rolls of the dice or spins of the wheel. It's the same with the universe. When the universe is big, as it is today, there are a very large number of rolls of the dice, and the results average out to something one can predict. That's why classical laws work for large systems. But when the universe is very small, as it was near in time to the Big Bang, there are only a small number of rolls of the dice, and the uncertainty principle is very important. Because the universe keeps on rolling the dice to see what happens next, it doesn't have just a single history, as one might have thought. Instead, the universe must have every possible history, each with its own probability. There must be a history of the universe in which Belize won every gold medal at the Olympic Games, though maybe the probability is low. This idea that the universe has multiple histories may sound like science fiction, but it is now accepted as science fact. It was formulated by Richard Feynman, who was both a great physicist and quite a character. Feynman's stories. Born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1918, Richard Feynman completed his PhD under John Wheeler at Princeton University in 1942. Shortly afterward, he was drawn into the Manhattan Project. He was known for both his exuberant personality and practical jokes. At the Los Alamos labs, he enjoyed cracking the top-secret safes, and for being an exceptional physicist. He became a key contributor to atomic bomb theory. Feynman's perpetual curiosity about the world was the very root of his being. It was not only the engine for his scientific success, it led him to numerous astonishing exploits, such as deciphering Mayan hieroglyphics. In the years following World War II, Feynman found a powerful new way of thinking about quantum mechanics, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1965. He challenged the basic classical assumption that each particle has one particular history. Instead, he suggested that particles travel from one location to another along every possible path through space-time. With each trajectory, Feynman associated two numbers, one for the size, the amplitude, of a wave, and one for its phase, whether it's at a crest or a trough. The probability of a particle going from A to B is found by adding up the waves associated with every possible path that passes through A and B. Nevertheless, in the everyday world, it seems to us that objects follow a single path between their origin and their final destination. This agrees with Feynman's multiple history idea, because for large objects, his rule for assigning numbers to each path ensures that all paths but one cancel out when their contributions are combined. Only one of the infinity of paths matters as far as the motion of macroscopic objects is concerned, and this trajectory is precisely the one emerging from Newton's classical laws of motion. We're now working to combine Einstein's general theory of relativity and Feynman's idea of multiple histories into a complete unified theory that will describe everything that happens in the universe. This unified theory will enable us to calculate how the universe will develop if we know how the histories started. But the unified theory will not in itself tell us how the universe began or what its initial state was. For that, we need what are called boundary conditions, rules that tell us what happens on the frontiers of the universe, the edges of space and time. If the frontier of the universe was just at a normal point of space and time, we could go past it and claim the territory beyond as part of the universe. On the other hand, if the boundary of the universe was at a jagged edge, where space and time were scrunched up and the density was infinite, it would be very difficult to define meaningful boundary conditions. However, a colleague named Jim Hartle and I realized there was a third possibility. Maybe the universe has no boundary in space and time. At first sight, this seems to be in direct contradiction with the theorems that Penrose and I proved, which showed that the universe must have a beginning, a boundary in time. However, as explained in Chapter 2, there is another kind of time called imaginary time that is at right angles to the ordinary real time that we feel going by. The history of the universe in real time determines its history in imaginary time, and vice versa. But the two kinds of history can be very different. In particular, the universe need have no beginning or end in imaginary time. Imaginary time behaves just like another direction in space. Thus, the histories of the universe in imaginary time can be thought of as curved surfaces, like a ball, a plane, or a saddle shape, but with four dimensions instead of two. If the histories of the universe went off to infinity, like a saddle or a plane, one would have the problem of specifying what the boundary conditions were at infinity. But one can avoid having to specify boundary conditions at all if the histories of the universe in imaginary time are closed surfaces, like the surface of the Earth. The surface of the Earth doesn't have any boundaries or edges. There are no reliable reports of people falling off. If the histories of the universe in imaginary time are indeed closed surfaces, as Hartle and I proposed, it would have fundamental implications for philosophy and our picture of where we came from. The universe would be entirely self-contained. It wouldn't need anything outside to wind up the clockwork and set it going. Instead, everything in the universe would be determined by the laws of science and by rolls of the dice within the universe. This may sound presumptuous, but it is what I and many other scientists believe. Even if the boundary condition of the universe is that it has no boundary, it won't have just a single history. It will have multiple histories, as suggested by Feynman. There will be a history in imaginary time corresponding to every possible closed surface, and each history in imaginary time will determine a history in real time. Thus, we have a superabundance of possibilities for the universe. What picks out the particular universe that we live in from the set of all possible universes? One point we can notice is that many of the possible histories of the universe won't go through the sequence of forming galaxies and stars that was essential to our own development. While it may be that intelligent beings can evolve without galaxies and stars, this seems unlikely. Thus, the very fact that we exist as beings who can ask the question, "Why is the universe the way it is?" is a restriction on the history we live in. It implies it is one of the minority of histories that have galaxies and stars. This is an example of what is called the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle. Roughly speaking, the anthropic principle says that we see the universe the way it is, at least in part, because we exist. It is a perspective that is diametrically opposed to the dream of a fully predictive, unified theory, in which the laws of nature are complete and the world is the way it is because it could not be otherwise. There are a number of different versions of the anthropic principle, ranging from those that are so weak as to be trivial to those that are so strong as to be absurd. Although most scientists are reluctant to adopt the strong version of the anthropic principle, few people would quarrel with the utility of some weak anthropic arguments. The weak anthropic principle amounts to an explanation of which of the various possible eras or parts of the universe we could inhabit. For instance, the reason why the Big Bang occurred about 10,000 million years ago is that the universe must be old enough so that some stars will have completed their evolution to produce elements like oxygen and carbon out of which we are made, and young enough so that some stars would still be providing energy to sustain life. Within the framework of the no-boundary proposal, one can use Feynman's rule for assigning numbers to each history of the universe to find which properties of the universe are likely to occur. In this context, the anthropic principle is implemented by requiring that the histories contain intelligent life. One would feel happier about the anthropic principle, of course, if one could show that a number of different initial configurations for the universe are likely to have evolved to produce a universe like the one we observe. This would imply that the initial state of the part of the universe that we inhabit did not have to be chosen with great care. The anthropic principle says that the universe has to be more or less as we see it, because if it were different, there wouldn't be anyone here to observe it. Many scientists dislike the anthropic principle because it seems rather vague and doesn't appear to have much predictive power. But the anthropic principle can be given a precise formulation, and it seems to be essential when dealing with the origin of the universe. M-theory, described in Chapter 2, allows a very large number of possible histories for the universe. Most of these histories are not suitable for the development of intelligent life. Either they are empty, last for too short a time, are too highly curved, or wrong in some other way. Yet according to Richard Feynman's idea of multiple histories, these uninhabited histories can have quite a high probability. In fact, it doesn't really matter how many histories there may be that don't contain intelligent beings. We're interested only in the subset of histories in which intelligent life develops. This intelligent life needn't be anything like humans. Little green aliens would do as well. In fact, they might do rather better. The human race doesn't have a very good record of intelligent behavior. As an example of the power of the anthropic principle, consider the number of directions in space. It's a matter of common experience that we live in three-dimensional space. That is to say, we can represent the position of a point in space by three numbers. For example, latitude, longitude, and height above sea level. But why is space three-dimensional? Why isn't it two or four or some other number of dimensions, as in science fiction? In M-theory, space has 9 or 10 dimensions, but it is thought that 6 or 7 of the directions are curled up very small, leaving 3 directions that are large and nearly flat. Why don't we live in a history in which 8 of the dimensions are curled up small, leaving only 2 dimensions that we notice? A two-dimensional animal would have a hard job digesting food. If it had a gut that went right through it, it would divide the animal in two, and the poor creature would fall apart. So 2 flat directions are not enough for anything as complicated as intelligent life. On the other hand, if there were 4 or more nearly flat directions, the gravitational force between 2 bodies would increase more rapidly as they approached each other. This would mean that planets would not have stable orbits about their suns. They would either fall into the sun or escape to the outer darkness and cold. Similarly, the orbits of electrons and atoms would not be stable, so matter as we know it wouldn't exist. Thus, although the idea of multiple histories would allow any number of nearly flat directions, only histories with 3 flat directions will contain intelligent beings. Only in such histories will the question be asked, why does space have 3 dimensions? The simplest history of the universe in imaginary time is a round sphere, like the surface of the Earth, but with 2 more dimensions. It determines a history of the universe in the real time that we experience, in which the universe is the same at every point of space and is expanding in time. In these respects, it is like the universe we live in, but the rate of expansion is very rapid, and it keeps on getting faster. Such accelerating expansion is called inflation, because it's like the way prices go up and up at an ever-increasing rate. Inflation may be a law of nature. Inflation in Germany rose after the peace until, by February 1920, the price level was 5 times as high as it had been in 1918. After July 1922, the phase of hyperinflation began. All confidence in money vanished, and the price index rose faster and faster for 15 months, outpacing the printing presses, which couldn't produce money as fast as it was depreciating. By late 1923, 300 paper mills were working at top speed, and 150 printing companies had 2,000 presses running day and night, turning out currency. Inflation in prices is generally held to be a bad thing, but in the case of the universe, inflation is very beneficial. The large amount of expansion smooths out any lumps and bumps that there may have been in the early universe. As the universe expands, it borrows energy from the gravitational field to create more matter. The positive matter energy is exactly balanced by the negative gravitational energy, so the total energy is zero. When the universe doubles in size, the matter and gravitational energies both double, so twice zero is still zero. If only the banking world were so simple. If the history of the universe in imaginary time were a perfectly round sphere, the corresponding history in real time would be a universe that continued to expand in an inflationary manner forever. While the universe is inflating, matter could not fall together to form galaxies and stars, and life, let alone intelligent life, like us, couldn't develop. Thus, although histories of the universe in imaginary time that are perfectly round spheres are allowed by the notion of multiple histories, they're not of much interest. However, histories in imaginary time that are slightly flattened at the south pole of the spheres are much more relevant. In this case, the corresponding history in real time will expand in an accelerated inflationary manner at first, but then the expansion will begin to slow down and galaxies can form. In order for intelligent life to be able to develop, the flattening at the South Pole must be very slight. This will mean that the universe will expand initially by an enormous amount. The record level of monetary inflation occurred in Germany between the World Wars, when prices rose billions of times. But the amount of inflation that must have occurred in the universe is at least a billion, billion, billion times that. Because of the uncertainty principle, there won't be just one history of the universe that contains intelligent life. Instead, the histories in imaginary time will be a whole family of slightly deformed spheres, each of which corresponds to a history in real time in which the universe inflates for a long time but not indefinitely. We could then ask, which of these allowable histories is the most probable? It turns out that the most probable histories are not completely smooth, but have tiny ups and downs. The ripples on the most probable histories really are minuscule. The departures from smoothness are of the order of 1 part in 100,000. Nevertheless, although they're extremely small, we've managed to observe them as small variations in the microwaves that come to us from different directions in space. The Cosmic Background Explorer satellite was launched in 1989 and made a map of the sky in microwaves. Different colors indicate different temperatures, but the whole range, from red to blue, is only about a 1/10th of a degree. Yet this is enough variation between different regions of the early universe for the extra gravitational attraction in the denser regions to stop them expanding eventually and to cause them to collapse again under their own gravity to form galaxies and stars. So in principle, at least, the COBE map is the blueprint for all the structures in the universe. What will be the future behavior of the most probable histories of the universe that are compatible with the appearance of intelligent beings? There seem to be various possibilities, depending on the amount of matter in the universe. If there's more than a certain critical amount, the gravitational attraction between the galaxies will slow them down and will eventually stop them from flying apart. They will then start falling towards each other and will all come together in a big crunch that will be the end of the history of the universe in real time. If the density of the universe is below the critical value, gravity is too weak to stop the galaxies from flying apart forever. All the stars will burn out and the universe will get increasingly emptier and colder. So again, things will come to an end. but in a less dramatic way. Either way, the universe will last a good few billion years more. As well as matter, the universe may contain what is called vacuum energy, energy that's present even in apparently empty space. By Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, this vacuum energy has mass. This means that it has a gravitational effect on the expansion of the universe. But remarkably enough, the effect of vacuum energy is the opposite of that of matter. Matter causes the expansion to slow down and can eventually stop and reverse it. On the other hand, vacuum energy causes the expansion to accelerate, as in inflation. In fact, vacuum energy acts just like the cosmological constant mentioned in Chapter 1, that Einstein added to his original equations in 1917, when he realized that they didn't admit a solution representing a static universe. After Hubble's discovery of the expansion of the universe, this motivation for adding a term to the equations disappeared, and Einstein rejected the cosmological constant as a mistake. However, it may not have been a mistake at all. As described in Chapter 2, we now realize that quantum theory implies that space-time is filled with quantum fluctuations. In a supersymmetric theory, the infinite positive and negative energies of these ground state fluctuations cancel out between particles of different spin. But we wouldn't expect the positive and negative energies to cancel so completely that there wasn't a small, finite amount of vacuum energy left over, because the universe is not in a supersymmetric state. The only surprise is that the vacuum energy is so nearly zero that it was not obvious some time ago. Maybe this is another example of the anthropic principle. A history with a larger vacuum energy would not have formed galaxies, so would not contain beings who could ask the question, why is the vacuum energy so low? We can try to determine the amounts of matter and vacuum energy in the universe from various observations. We can show the results in a diagram in which the matter density is a horizontal direction and vacuum energy is a vertical direction. A dotted line shows the boundary of the region in which intelligent life could develop. Observations of supernovas, clustering, and the microwave background each mark out regions in this diagram. Fortunately, all three regions have a common intersection. If the matter density and vacuum energy lie in this intersection, it means that the expansion of the universe has begun to speed up again after a long period of slowing down. It seems that inflation may be a law of nature. In this chapter, we've seen how the behavior of the vast universe can be understood in terms of its history in imaginary time, which is a tiny, slightly flattened sphere. It is like Hamlet's nutshell. Yet this nut encodes everything that happens in real time. So Hamlet was quite right. We could be bounded in a nutshell and still count ourselves kings of infinite space. Chapter 4. Predicting the Future. How the loss of information in black holes may reduce our ability to predict the future. The human race has always wanted to control the future, or at least to predict what will happen. That's why astrology is so popular. Astrology claims that events on Earth are related to the motions of the planets across the sky. This is a scientifically testable hypothesis, or would be if astrologers stuck their necks out and made definite predictions that could be tested. However, wisely enough, they make their forecasts so vague that they can apply to any outcome. Statements such as, personal relations may become intense, or you will have a financially rewarding opportunity, can never be proved wrong. But the real reason most scientists don't believe in astrology is not scientific evidence or the lack of it, but because it's not consistent with other theories that have been tested by experiment. When Copernicus and Galileo discovered that the planets orbit the sun rather than the earth, and Newton discovered the laws that govern their motion, astrology became extremely implausible. Why should the positions of other planets against the background sky, as seen from Earth, have any correlations with the macromolecules on a minor planet that call themselves intelligent life? Yet this is what astrology would have us believe. There is no more experimental evidence for some of the theories described in this book than there is for astrology, but we believe them because they are consistent with theories that have survived testing. The success of Newton's laws and other physical theories led to the idea of scientific determinism, which was first expressed at the beginning of the 19th century by the French scientist, the Marquis de Laplace. Laplace suggested that if we knew the positions and velocities of all the particles in the universe at one time, the laws of physics should allow us to predict what the state of the universe would be at any other time, in the past or in the future. In other words, if scientific determinism holds, we should in principle be able to predict the future and wouldn't need astrology. Of course, in practice, even something as simple as Newton's theory of gravity produces equations that we can't solve exactly for more than two particles. Furthermore, the equations often have a property known as chaos, so that a small change in position or velocity at one time can lead to completely different behavior at later times. As those who've seen Jurassic Park know, a tiny disturbance in one place can cause a major change in another. A butterfly flapping its wings in Tokyo can cause rain in New York Central Park. And the trouble is, the sequence of events is not repeatable. The next time the butterfly flaps its wings, a host of other factors will be different and will also influence the weather. That's why weather forecasts are so unreliable. Thus, although in principle the laws of quantum electrodynamics should allow us to calculate everything in chemistry and biology, we've not had much success in predicting human behavior from mathematical equations. Nevertheless, despite these practical difficulties, most scientists have comforted themselves with the idea that, again in principle, the future is predictable. At first sight, determinism would also seem to be threatened by the uncertainty principle, which says that we can't measure accurately both the position and the velocity of a particle at the same time. The more accurately we measure the position, the less accurately we can determine the velocity, and vice versa. The Laplace version of scientific determinism held that if we knew the positions and velocities of particles at one time, we could determine their positions and velocities at any time in the past or future. But how could we even get started if the uncertainty principle prevented us from knowing accurately both the positions and the velocities at one time? However good our computer is, if we put lousy data in, we get lousy predictions out. However, determinism was restored in a modified form in a new theory called quantum mechanics, which incorporated the uncertainty principle. In quantum mechanics, one can, roughly speaking, accurately predict half of what one would expect to predict in the classical Laplace point of view. In quantum mechanics, a particle doesn't have a well-defined position or velocity, but its state can be represented by what is called a wave function. A wave function is a number at each point of space that gives the probability that the particle is to be found at that position. The rate at which the wave function changes from point to point tells how probable different particle velocities are. Some wave functions are sharply peaked at a particular point in space. In these cases, there is only a small amount of uncertainty in the position of the particle. But we can also see in the diagram that in such cases, the wave function changes rapidly near the point, up on one side and down on the other. That means the probability distribution for the velocity is spread over a wide range. In other words, the uncertainty in the velocity is large. Consider, on the other hand, a continuous train of waves. Now there is a large uncertainty in position, but a small uncertainty in velocity. So the description of a particle by a wave function does not have a well-defined position or velocity. It satisfies the uncertainty principle. We now realize that the wave function is all that can be well-defined. We can't even suppose that the particle has a position and velocity that are known to God, but are hidden from us. Such hidden variable theories predict results that are not in agreement with observation. Even God is bound by the uncertainty principle and can't know the position and velocity. He can only know the wave function. The rate at which the wave function changes with time is given by what is called the Schrödinger equation. If we know the wave function at one time, we can use the Schrödinger equation to calculate it at any other time, past or future. Therefore, there is still determinism in quantum theory, but it's on a reduced scale. Instead of being able to predict both the positions and the velocities, we can predict only the wave function. This can allow us to predict either the positions or the velocities, but not both accurately. Thus, in quantum theory, the ability to make exact predictions is just half what it was in the classical Laplace worldview. Nevertheless, within this restricted sense, it is still possible to claim that there is determinism. However, the use of the Schrödinger equation to evolve the wave function forward in time, that is, to predict what it will be at future times, implicitly assumes that time runs on smoothly, everywhere, forever. This was certainly true in Newtonian physics. Time was assumed to be absolute, meaning that each event in the history of the universe was labeled by a number called time, and that a series of time labels ran smoothly from the infinite past to the infinite future. This is what might be called the common sense view of time, and it is the view of time that most people and even most physicists have at the back of their minds. However, in 1905, as we've seen, the concept of absolute time was overthrown by the special theory of relativity, in which time was no longer an independent quantity on its own, but was just one direction in a four-dimensional continuum called space-time. In special relativity, different observers traveling at different velocities move through space-time on different paths. Each observer has his or her own measure of time along the path he or she is following, and different observers will measure different intervals of time between events. Thus, in special relativity, there is no unique absolute time that we can use to label events. However, the space-time of special relativity is flat. This means that in special relativity, the time measured by any freely moving observer increases smoothly in space-time from minus infinity in the infinite past to plus infinity in the infinite future. We can use any of these measures of time in the Schrödinger equation to evolve the wave function. In special relativity, therefore, we still have the quantum version of determinism. The situation was different in the general theory of relativity, in which space-time was not flat but curved and distorted by the matter and energy in it. In our solar system, the curvature of space-time is so slight, at least on a macroscopic scale, that it doesn't interfere with our usual idea of time. In this situation, we could still use this time in the Schrödinger equation to get a deterministic evolution of the wave function. However, once we allow space-time to be curved, the door is open to the possibility that it may have a structure that doesn't admit a time that increases smoothly for every observer, as we would expect for a reasonable measure of time. For example, suppose that space-time was like a vertical cylinder. Height up the cylinder would be a measure of time that increased for every observer and ran from minus infinity to plus infinity. However, imagine instead that space-time was like a cylinder with a handle or wormhole that branched off and then joined back. Then any measure of time would necessarily have stagnation points where the handle joined the main cylinder, points where time stood still. At these points, time would not increase for any observer. In such a space-time, we couldn't use the Schrödinger equation to get a deterministic evolution for the wave function. Watch out for wormholes. You never know what may come out of them. Black holes are the reason we think time will not increase for every observer. The first discussion of black holes appeared in 1783. A former Cambridge Don, John Mitchell, presented the following argument. If one fires a particle, such as a cannonball, vertically upward, its ascent will be slowed by gravity, and eventually the particle will stop moving upward and will fall back. However, if the initial upward velocity is greater than a critical value called the escape velocity, gravity will never be strong enough to stop the particle, and it will get away. The escape velocity is about 12 kilometers per second for the Earth and about 100 kilometers per second for the Sun. Both of these escape velocities are much higher than the speed of real cannonballs, but they're small compared to the speed of light, which is 300,000 kilometers per second. Thus, light can get away from the Earth or Sun without much difficulty. However, Mitchell argued that there could be stars that are much more massive than the Sun and have escape velocities greater than the speed of light. We would not be able to see these stars because any light they sent out would be dragged back by the gravity of the star. Thus, they would be what Mitchell called dark stars, and we now call black holes. Mitchell's idea of dark stars was based on Newtonian physics, in which time was absolute and went on regardless of what happened. Thus, they didn't affect our ability to predict the future in the classical Newtonian picture. But the situation was very different in the general theory of relativity, in which massive bodies curve space-time. In 1916, shortly after the theory was first formulated, Karl Schwarzschild, who died soon after of an illness contracted on the Russian front in the First World War, found a solution of the field equations of general relativity that represented a black hole. The Schwarzschild Black Hole. Schwarzschild's work revealed a stunning implication of general relativity. He showed that if the mass of a star is concentrated in a small enough region, the gravitational field at the surface of the star becomes so strong that even light can no longer escape. This is what we now call a black hole, a region of space-time bounded by a so-called event horizon from which it is impossible for anything, including light, to reach a distant observer. For a long time, most physicists, including Einstein, were skeptical whether such extreme configurations of matter could actually ever occur in the real universe. However, we now understand that when any sufficiently heavy, non-rotating star, however complicated its shape and internal structure, runs out of nuclear fuel, it will necessarily collapse to a perfectly spherical Schwarzschild black hole. What Schwarzschild had found wasn't understood or its importance recognized for many years. Einstein himself never believed in black holes, and his attitude was shared by most of the old guard in general relativity. I remember going to Paris to give a seminar on my discovery that quantum theory means that black holes aren't completely black. My seminar fell rather flat because at that time almost no one in Paris believed in black holes. The French also felt that the name, as they translated it, trou noir, had dubious sexual connotations and should be replaced by astre occlu, or hidden star. However, neither this nor other suggested names caught the public imagination, like the term black hole, which was first introduced by John Archibald Wheeler, the American physicist who inspired much of the modern work in this field. John Wheeler. John Archibald Wheeler was born in 1911 in Jacksonville, Florida. He earned his PhD from Johns Hopkins University in 1933 for his work on the scattering of light by the helium atom. In 1938, he worked with the Danish physicist Niels Bohr to develop the theory of nuclear fission. For a while thereafter, Wheeler, together with his graduate student Richard Feynman, concentrated on the study of electrodynamics. But shortly after America entered World War II, both went on to contribute to the Manhattan Project. In the early 1950s, inspired by Robert Oppenheimer's work in 1939 on the gravitational collapse of a massive star, Wheeler turned his attention to Einstein's theory of general relativity. At that time, most physicists were caught up in the study of nuclear physics, and general relativity was not really regarded as relevant to the physical world. But almost single-handedly, Wheeler transformed the field, both through his research and through his teaching of Princeton's first course on relativity. Much later, in 1969, he coined the term black hole for the collapsed state of matter, which few yet believed was real. Inspired by the work of Werner Israel, he conjectured that black holes have no hair, which meant that the collapsed state of any non-rotating massive star could in fact be described by Schwarzschild's solution. The discovery of quasars in 1963 brought forth an outburst of theoretical work on black holes and observational attempts to detect them. Here's the picture that has emerged. Consider what we believe would be the history of a star with a mass 20 times that of the Sun. Such stars form from clouds of gas, like those in the Orion Nebula. As clouds of gas contract under their own gravity, the gas heats up and eventually becomes hot enough to start the nuclear fusion reaction that converts hydrogen into helium. The heat generated by this process creates a pressure that supports the star against its own gravity and stops it from contracting further. A star will stay in this state for a long time, burning hydrogen and radiating light into space. The gravitational field of the star will affect the paths of light rays coming from it. One can draw a diagram with time plotted upward and distance from the center of the star plotted horizontally. In this diagram, the surface of the star is represented by two vertical lines. one on either side of the center. One can choose that time be measured in seconds and distance in light seconds, the distance light travels in a second. When we use these units, the speed of light is one. That is, the speed of light is one light second per second. This means that far from the star and its